CliffCentral.com.
The Dean Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with me, Kingsley Kipuri, on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. That'll be with me for the next hour. My comrade Greg Nicholson is not in studio with us today, so you'll have to bear with just me. You may also notice I've got a case of the man flu, so you'll also have to persevere with that too. I mean, we all get the flu, but I feel like when men get it, it's particularly spectacular. You know, we're aching and we're moaning and making sure everybody knows in how much pain we are. So you'll have to persevere with me throughout the next hour. But really, thank you for joining us, and I'm really excited to spend the next hour with you. Today we'll be continuing what I feel is now a national conversation, thankfully, about gender-based violence. With the sort of tragic news of Karabo Mokoena a few weeks ago and just continuing stories coming to the surface of murder, of kidnapping, of harm, of rape continuously on a day-to-day basis of women and girls in South Africa, I believe, and I'm glad that there's sort of a resurfacing of the outrage that pours out once in a while when these things happen. So we're looking to continue that and channel that and look perhaps more at a more sort of process and system level and say, what are the key pieces that contribute to fixing this? So what is a medical angle? What is a judicial and criminal justice angle? What is a sociocultural element? And how do we have a better understanding of the different pieces that fit into this? Greg had a wonderful metaphor this, which is when we talk about Eskom, people have a pretty decent sense of the different pieces, right? They talk about energy mix, or you talk about affordability, or you're talking about, you know, load shedding, and we've, regardless of what side you're on, we can agree on the sort of, when we're having an energy debate, we can agree on the sort of the center of, you know, of facts or different levels that we need to discuss to move forward, right? But we feel that when it comes to issues of, you know, of rape and gender-based violence, for some reason, we lose that. Perhaps it's because it can be a very emotional issue, understandably. But we, you know, there seems to be calls for capital punishment or a call for this. But we feel perhaps there needs to be a better understanding. What are the preventative measures that are working? What are the preventive measures that need help scaling up? What are the preventive measures that need more awareness or more help? What's the role of community engagement and activism? What is the role of criminal justice? Does criminal justice work at all? So we're going to be hoping to push that conversation forward, and I'll be joined by, you know, very sort of esteemed and educated people who've worked in this field for a long time on a community level, at a national level, and I'll have to go to them shortly because they're making faces at me. We have Nonklantla Skosana, who's a community mobilizer from Sonke Gender Justice. Nonklantla, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Why are you making faces when I call you an expert?
Your introduction is very scary.
No, you're doing excellent work and you should not be ashamed of that. Okay. Also, we have Maurice Smithers, who's the executive director of the Yeovil Community Development Trust. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
Also, yes. Do you accept the mantle of somebody who's doing good work in this?
We do what we can.
But genuinely, thank you both for joining me. I'm very excited to sort of start to have this conversation. So I'd love to start with sort of, you know, a case study, for lack of, you know, a better term, which can be very academic. But I think it's important before we jump into policy and process, you know, it can sound quite abstract. But I feel if, you know, if we ground it in something that's happening in reality, I feel like that'd be quite helpful as we move forward. So Maurice, just coming to you, I'd love if you could sort of talk us through what happened in the case of one sort of Patrick Wisani, who about 2 years ago, if I'm not wrong, was alleged to have beaten his partner to death, and that case recently came to an end. So I'd love if you just sort of talk us through right from the beginning. Who was Patrick Wisani, and what is this case that happened?
Okay, well, Patrick Wisani, he was at the time that he was arrested, he was, I think, active in the Community Police Forum. Mm. He was also the zonal leader of the ANC Youth League in Johannesburg. I knew him, I'd been around him in the area for quite some time because of living there myself and working in the area. And got to know him not very well, but observed his development as he came into the area, because he wasn't from the area originally. He came from elsewhere, I think from Soweto, I'm not sure. And observed how he quickly got sucked into a very negative and antisocial mode of behavior. which was linked to politics and police and corruption and a whole range of factors. But the key thing about around this particular case, for me, hinges on something that happened in 2012, where he was actually alleged to have beaten a woman in a shebeen so badly that she ended up in a coma. And at the time, I was on the police forum, and we arranged for him to be suspended from the police forum because he had been chairperson of Sector 1 of the police forum. And we said, look, you know, you can't be accused of this kind of activity and carry on being a member of the CPF, and therefore it's got to get sorted out before you can continue to serve here. So he was suspended, and what was interesting was, first of all, the police were very reticent about charging him. I didn't make any real effort to support the family or support anybody in the community that wanted actually for him to be charged. But then there was a meeting that was held to elect someone as the chairperson of the sector. And in that particular meeting, he was nominated for the position that he was suspended from, which was quite extraordinary. So I raised the question in the meeting. It was about 50 people, including, you know, some senior leaders in the community. And I raised the question of why. Surely he shouldn't be allowed to stand, because we just had a conversation about the kinds of qualities a person should have to be a leader. And secondly, he's still facing this case. Lo and behold, not one single person in the room supported me. And that included the head of the police station, the ward councillor, the head of the CPF cluster, and a representative from the office of the MEC for community safety, plus other leaders in the community who had been on the CPF and who were in other structures and so on. Not one single person supported me. So the message, and this is quite critical in my view to what happened in 2015, the message that Patrick Wasani received on that day was, it's okay to beat women. We will defend you. Okay, we will support you. We will back you. We will protect you. Instead, if the message to him had been very clear, you have done, you know, you're alleged to have done wrong, until it's sorted out, you're going to have to be resolved, but we're going to sit down with you and talk you through these issues, explain to you, you know, try and understand why you did this thing, and so on. Provided leadership, provided guidance. Didn't happen. And, you know, 3 years later, he did exactly the same, even worse, assaulted his partner. On the previous occasion, it wasn't his partner. He assaulted her and beat her to death. In court, they said that he was so filled with rage that he actually went beyond what anybody could have possibly expected. That, you know, she basically bled to death. She had 40 distinctive wounds on her body. In my view, the seeds for that event in September 2015 were sown back in 2012.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, on an extreme, you expect that, you know, the idea would be at the very least serious social shaming for once this news comes out. At the very least, some roadblocks, if you're elevated or put forward for a leadership position, at the very least, you'd expect there to be some roadblocks between you and that position, and it sounds like there were absolutely none.
There were none, and I think that's an endemic problem in our society, that men get protected in these kinds of situations. Absolutely. You know, there's a kind of acceptance that men can talk about these things, do these things, and unless they overstep certain bounds, like in the case of Wasani when he actually killed his partner, and you know, you couldn't hide that anymore. But even then, we were worried about whether, in fact, he was going to get properly charged. We were worried that maybe there was be some kind of political gerrymandering or something of that nature which would get him off. But I think that happens in society a lot. The people get protected. It's somehow tolerated. And then we wonder
why people do these things.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you've jumped now. So that happened in 2012. We're now in 2015, and you know it emerges that you know the charges are formally pressed that he's alleged to have killed his partner by beating her to death. And during that trial, I mean, that trial started in 2015, right? And this was resolved quite recently. Sort of, there's a lot of questions to be asked about what played out in there. I mean, one of those is the issue of bail. Could you just speak about how bail was set and how that affected his ability to then access people who were willing to testify that he was actually the killer?
Well, first of all, the bail was set at a very low level. In fact, it was quite ironic because in the same week that he was given bail of 3,000 rand, 14 students who were part of the Fees Must Fall campaign, the initial one, in Cape Town had attempted to enter Parliament and were arrested. And each one of them was released on bail in the same week. What was the bail amount? 3,000 rand. So, you know, the fact that somebody's lost their life, and that is equated with just going into Parliament to go and protest about something, that both people get charged 3,000 rand bail. I mean, so the second thing is that Patrick, he was given bail and he was supposed to live in the West Rand. He was supposed to report to the West Rand police every day and so on. He basically didn't really follow through. Mm. He was seen in Yeovil a number of times. Nobody reported it. The police weren't really following up on him. And so, yes, he was able to have this kind of threatening presence, if you like, for the people who were going to give evidence. Mm. And then in May of 2016, he, in fact, assaulted the twin sister of the woman that he had killed in an attempt to intimidate her into silence because she was going to give evidence against him and also beat up her friend who was with her at the time. Fortunately, and I have to say, and I've said this a number of times and I'll say it again, I was completely astonished at the bravery of the three women, the three key witnesses, which is the sister, the twin sister, another woman living in the house where the event took place, and then the other woman who was assaulted with the sister. All of them testified in court, despite the fact that they were under such threat, despite the fact that that it was not just Wasani himself, but the problem is that around Wasani, there's a group of people as well who also were being quite threatening towards them, and yet they withstood the intimidation and actually did it. But I mean, the fact is that he used that opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that raises the issue of bail. So I know that a lot of people say that the criminal justice system is limited when dealing with something like violence. Sure. But surely that's a key thing that's worth bringing up. And what is the role of bail when somebody can go back and, you know, intimidate witnesses and cause further harm? Is that something you see as a key?
Well, I mean, if they were serious about monitoring the movement of the people and making sure that they comply with what they do. I mean, I remember, to give you a completely different example, back in the 1980s, when people were banned, you know, they had to report to a police station once a week. Mm. And if you didn't report to the police station, you would get arrested. When Wasani was when they went looking for him after he assaulted the sister in Hillbrow, they couldn't find him because he wasn't staying at the place where he was supposed to be staying. Yeah. Did they ever check? You know, so the point is, if you're going to release people on bail, and I'm not saying that, I mean, the bail system is an international system. That's how it works.
Yeah.
You get released on bail because it's deemed to be, prejudicial to your rights if you just get kept in jail when you're not actually convicted. So if you're going to release people, at least make sure you put systems in place that will prevent them from abusing that situation.
And absolutely. And continuing with the case, there were also significant sort of judicial issues. One with a judge who was, you know, I think, I'm not sure if this has been said openly, but seemed to be incompetent or at least very confused with what was happening.
Look, I think we should be careful about that case. Okay. I don't know if you know that he actually committed suicide just before the trial ended, before the sentencing was done recently. And apparently he was very depressed, was on medication and so on and so forth. And so it was a very unfortunate situation, to be honest. I mean, we were very concerned because we were observing this thing and we were very worried about whether justice would be done. Fortunately, the prosecutor, much more experienced than we were, I guess, in court matters, realized there was a problem and asked him to recuse himself. And I suppose to the judge's credit, he did agree to recuse himself. But that did cause a delay.
Absolutely.
Because then we had to start the whole trial again with a new judge.
Okay.
Who, I must say, I think handled the case incredibly well and gave a very reasoned judgment at the end, even though we weren't totally satisfied with the sentence.
Thank you for correcting me. I did not know that. And you're right.
No, it's not public knowledge. Okay. It was briefly reported in the paper, but it was a very sad case, actually.
Thank you for that. But I'm curious, and maybe the answer is yes. And I'm just thinking, in a lower profile case, with a different set of lawyers, do you feel that the prosecution on the other side has the ability to say something's amiss here and is able to get perhaps apply pressure for a judge to recuse himself or for that sort of thing to happen? Does that happen in a lower profile case? Do you see that happening?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think a prosecutor is a prosecutor, and if a prosecutor feels that there's a problem, I guess he or she can actually raise that kind of an issue. Whether the judge will respond and whether also they knew, both of them, the judge and the prosecutor, knew that they were in the limelight because we as civil society were paying a lot of attention to the case, and we had also managed to galvanize some media, not enough. But we had managed to galvanize some media to cover the case. So I guess that may have had some impact. And so maybe you're right. Maybe a much lower profile case would be more difficult. Yeah.
Okay. And lastly, just the element of sort of lawyer fees and ability to pay. Some of the delays were around, claims that Wasani could not pay his lawyers. I mean, on one hand, you have perhaps deliberate stalling tactics. We don't know. But I'm just thinking of the wider issue of just people's ability to afford legal teams and competent legal teams. Do you also see that as a barrier to effective justice on matters like this?
Well, I think so. I mean, look, in Wasani's case, you must remember some murder cases get dealt with in the magistrate's court.
Yeah.
And the reason why, as I understand it, and we learned quite a bit from this case, what I understand if it's a cut and dried case, in other words, the person was observed, there are witnesses, they were observed doing the deed, and so on and so forth. If there's pretty well very little doubt that the person actually did it, then the case will get dealt with in the magistrate's court. However, if there is, in the case of Wasani, nobody actually saw it happening. People heard the screaming and they went to the room and Wasani came out with a broomstick in his hand with blood on it. But it was circumstantial evidence. Okay. So when a case like that happens, it gets taken to the High Court. Mm. Once it goes to the High Court, it becomes extremely difficult for anyone because advocates just charge huge amounts of money. So I think there was I don't think it was just delaying tactics. I think it was genuinely that Wasani didn't have money. He's not a rich person. He was living in a hijacked house in Yeovil. Just getting peace jobs through government projects and that kind of stuff. He wasn't a wealthy person at all. So eventually he was offered legal aid and turned it down mainly because he couldn't reach agreement with legal aid and then defended himself until the end when he had to get an advocate to help him in the sentencing process. Yeah, but I do think that the justice system is not accessible to although you see, you must remember in a case like that, in a criminal case, the prosecutors are the ones who arguing the case. So it's whether people can defend themselves adequately or not. In this case, I think Wasani had plenty of opportunity to do that, and at the end of the day, the evidence was too much against him, and he was convicted. Thank goodness. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. I'm curious about the role of sort of community action and sort of civil society paying attention to something and say, hey, this is something that we need to pay attention to and make sure sort of justice is served and make sure that there's enough public attention on this. Now, Clancla, we haven't heard from you yet. I'm curious about what do you think the role of civil society was in a case like this? Do you think there are key times where that galvanized element and that element of pointing attention to it enabled justice to be served better or enabled better outcomes in any way?
I really think so, because in the Yeovil-Belleville coalition, we had a different number of stakeholders, you know, organizations that have been there, you know, dealt with such cases. We had POWA. We know that POWA is experienced in terms of dealing with cases of domestic violence and gender-based violence. But we also had the Lawyers for Human Rights who were, like, giving us legal advice, and we had organizations that like Awe2 who are more skilled in terms of community work. So in terms of monitoring the case, like what Morris was saying, engaging with the prosecutor, because one thing that we observe in our communities is that members of our community don't know, or they are not geared up in a way that they could even start questioning issues around the investigation of the case, because even in this very same case, we had to, you know, probe that the investigating officer be changed. So those are some of the things that community members might not have the kind of information. But when you are a number of organizations and stakeholders working together, capable of being able to be exposing that kind of information, and also in this case, you know, in engaging with the NPA, having meetings with the NPA regarding this case, I think those are kind of the strengths of civil society organizations. So for me, I would say our involvement in this case and monitoring from onset until the end, even, you know, the judge could see a number of people who were there, women and men from Yeovil who were there. I could say he did his job very well, but also I think the pressure that they got, both of them, the prosecutor and the judge, as Morit has said, you know, it has really, you know, assisted in terms of saying we get this kind of sentence that was issued out, as much as we were not happy about it. And I think it is important that civil society organizations work together and, you know, pool the kind of resources that they have to make sure that, you know, victims and their families are being supported and they get the proper services. And one thing that I also would like to highlight is the fact that we need to have, you know, community engagement regarding these kind of cases and being able to educate our communities about our justice system and what are their rights and how they can engage with the system as well.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, thank you to both for that awesome sort of, not awesome, but important breakdown of, I think just looking at sort of some of the steps where things that are supposed to happen don't happen or don't quite happen, I think just illustrates how sort of complex the challenges are, and hopefully that's a good starting point into as we move towards solutions.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, with the Wisani case, it was a very scary case. People were not free to talk. They were intimidated, you know, they felt that they're not safe because of, you know, the kind of relationships that Wisani had. He even mentioned that some of the SAPS guys are on his payroll. So he had, you know, very useful relationships to him, and I think he even thought he would get away with it, because the manner in which he handled himself, you know, even if he was presenting and representing himself, he was, you know, very sure of himself, because he knows who he's connected to. But unfortunately, because this case was monitored, and he was even asked, why do you think the media is so interested into this case? And he also said, I am also shocked, you know. So this was not something that he thought it would really happen. And he thought he would really manage to go away with it, as he was always doing. So community involvement, civil society organization, working together, sharing the skills that they have, it makes it possible for the victim and the family not to carry the burden of finances in terms of being able to attend the course. Because we know that most of victims and families, they just decide not to go on with the case because it becomes a bit expensive and a bit taxi, emotional. emotionally and psychologically.
It took a long time.
Yeah. So as we contributed from one organization to another financially, with the skills that organization had, that brought that day where I think Unoxolo, Umamaga, Nosipho, you know, really find some peace. Yeah.
Thank you. That's incredible work from you personally and the both of you. I'd love to sort of pivot towards something that Sonke has been quite vocal in pushing for, which is a national strategic plan on gender-based violence. Mm-hmm. So in a country where we hear a lot about plans and we hear a lot about sort of frameworks and task teams, a lot of people cringe when they hear. Right. A lot of people cringe when they hear we need a plan, or we need. A lot of people cringe and say, "Oh no, that thing is going to happen again." Where people go off, they develop policy, they take a year, they do a task team, and we never hear about it again. Could you tell us a bit about why you're so sort of adamant and in pushing for a national strategic plan, and how that differs from the integrated program that we have now?
Mm-hmm. I think we have learned how well the HIV and AIDS National Strategic Plan worked. Mm. So we're benchmarking on that because, you know, it also covers on issues of prevention and also, you know, services for the victims. And we also say this plan will be costed. We would know how much it costs because we know the KPMG report, it has really highlighted how much South Africa is losing in terms of the money that is used to deal with gender-based violence. Mm. They are costing it in around 24 to 42 billion rands. And if we can have the plan and be able, the plan will also involve a number of civil society organizations. And we know that we had a GBV council that was, you know, had a very slow death and just disappeared in thin air, and that council will also assist in terms of saying how do we monitor this national strategic plan on GBV. So this is well, you know, worked plan, and a number of organizations, about 48 organizations are involved in terms of developing this plan and pushing and advocating for this plan to happen.
Okay, and is there an element of perhaps better coordination, and Maurice, you can jump in here, about saying once you have a national strategic plan, there suddenly is a platform for sort of different arms of government, different arms of civil society to now sort of be unified under sort of an umbrella that now works sort of in a coordinated way in one direction. Is that something that perhaps needs more work?
Well, I think it has to. Yeah. I mean, the reality is that, I mean, it's quite good to see that right now there's a lot of, in fact, we're trying to understand why there's so much attention being paid to the issue of gender-based violence in the last 2 weeks, because it's for me, it's an open question as to whether, in fact, there are that many more cases. Yeah. Or is it just a kind of coincidence that the Wasani case sentencing happened on the same day that the Karabo case became big news, and then a number of other cases came out as well? The problem is that it's just like with xenophobia, it's going to die down.
Yep.
And then people will forget about it and life will carry on as normal. Because this is not the first time that this kind of attention has been paid to GBV and then just kind of become gone off the agenda because something else has come onto the agenda. So I think having a proper plan that then engages with civil society and government on a consistent and ongoing basis, I think is going to actually will actually be much better. Because the challenge we have, I think, is also reaching an understanding of what needs to be done.
Okay.
I mean, you mentioned earlier on capital punishment. People, you know, and I happened to have a conversation yesterday with the guy who works in our garden, and we were talking about this GBV issue, and he was saying to me, "Bring back the death penalty." I'm reminded also that when we were interviewed after the sentencing, that the media said to us, "Do you think that this thing is going to, the sentence is going to dissuade other people from committing murder?" It's not.
Yeah.
If it did, you know, the people know that people are getting sentenced. I mean, there's big news with a number of different cases, like the Pistorius case and various other cases where it's been very, very public. Mm. But people carry on doing these things. The judicial system is not going to solve the problem. Society has to solve the problem. And we need to look at what's happening in society. What are we doing, consciously or subconsciously, in society to create the Wasanis of this world?
Mm.
to create the I've forgotten Karabo's the guy who killed Karabo. What are we doing to create those people? Because they don't come from nowhere.
I hear you, and I think that's probably part of the fear, is that when we frame the problem as such a big one, perhaps it paralyzes us a bit. I know I need to let you both go. I'm just curious about, on the immediate sort of response side of things that we do now, are there any things that we're doing well? Some people mentioned the Tutuzela centers as something that's working, and perhaps if we put more resources towards and scaled up a bit, that's something that we're doing now that's perhaps an easy win. Just do that, more of that thing. No, Clanka, are you able to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think in terms of the available structures, we have what we call the victim empowerment offices in each and every police station. Are they working? That is questionable. I think we need to be able to monitor that.
Yeah.
It is a good idea. It could assist because people have access to police stations. Tutuzela care centers, we've got 51 of them in this country. They are based in public hospital. Yes, some of them, they are working very well. Some of them, they still have challenges.
Okay.
So I think Lisa has made some kind of assessment of all the Tutuzela centers, highlighted the gap. The major gap is the NGOs who are providing psychosocial support to the victims of domestic violence or gender-based violence. We need funding for those. And that is why we are pushing for the NSP, GPV, that, you know, we need to cost that and be able to provide resources to different stakeholders who are trying to deal with gender-based violence in this country.
And I hear you. You can't escape the fact that until this is fully costed and in the budget, and until there's clear outcomes that can be tracked and people held accountable for, you know, we won't get where we need to get.
I mean, I think it should be mentioned that there are, you know, we talk about Sonke, we talked about Power today, but there are a myriad organizations around the country that are trying to deal with this issue. And we're talking about some organizations that are of women in particular, but men also sometimes, who come together to try and deal with these issues, and they do it on a shoestring budget, and they do it with absolute commitment, absolute dedication, dealing with quite horrific situations. So even the people who get engaged in these things themselves become traumatized and become probably victims of post-traumatic stress disorder, having to deal with the traumas of other people who've been assaulted, raped, and so on and so forth. So I think one has to actually acknowledge the incredible work that has been done, and the fact that society as a whole doesn't support the work that's been done by these organizations. That's where the problem lies. That's where the challenge lies, is how do we, and that's why I say society as a whole has to take responsibility for this, and not just to go on a march or to, you know, make a bit of noise in the newspaper and so on, but to actually on a consistent way deal with these from school, you know, in schools and in churches, in faith-based organizations. What are we doing? How are we handling things? What are we talking about? What kind of, you know, things are we tolerating and accepting? You know, or is it that we, you know, that it's like the Trump mentality, you know, where you talk about locker room talk, where people do things and say things which are somehow deemed to be acceptable, but not realizing what that's doing to the consciousness of the people who actually are hearing these things and saying these things. And we have an example right now of the minister in the president's office, Jeff Khadebe, exchanging these bizarre sexual exchanges with a photographer who's like 40 years younger than him, and he's supposed to be like a leading pillar of society and has been up until now, and yet somehow it's okay to send those kinds of messages to somebody. It's deemed to be okay until you get caught, you know, then suddenly it's a big issue. But when people do that kind of thing and it gets tolerated, that's what then builds this kind of mentality that people have. So we've got to look at it, you know, right? What are we doing in our homes? How are we bringing up our kids? Just think about how many families bring up their kids to make boys believe that they are better than girls, that women must serve them. Women must, you know, that they are, and girls are geared to believe that as they grow up, they are there to serve and service men. You know, these are the kinds of things that we as a society are doing, and which lay the foundation for the kind of mentality of people who then do the kind of things that Rosani does, or all of the other many, many people in the country that actually do these things on a daily basis. It's happening right now as we speak.
You're right.
You can be absolutely sure that a woman in South Africa is being beaten or raped.
And also, I think one thing that I would also just like to highlight is the fact that men are now responding.
Yeah.
But how are you responding? How are you responding? Because I was talking to Maurice on our way here to say, we had this big march in Pretoria where, you know, men were saying they're taking responsibility. They
not
want
in
to
my
be
name.
Not in my name. But what are they doing? They are now calling the victims of sexual violence to come telling their stories. And those victims are women, about four of them. And they have this kind of an artwork of a woman who's wearing a white dress. We're saying we need men to tell their own stories, their stories of change. Who were perpetrators of gender-based violence? How did they change? And how can they get engaged with one another and change the language that they use when they talk about women, you know, about the kind of violence that they perpetrate against women? So we're having this march on the 26th on Friday in Soweto. I hope the narrative will change, because now we've heard about Garabo, we've heard about Nosipo, and, you know, we heard about the number of lesbian women who are killed in our community. We need to see men changing, and we're saying there are resources, as Sonke and other organizations, TAC, we have material that we can give to them and say, this is what, these are the steps that you need to take, and this is how you need to deal with victims of gender-based violence. So we're just saying, let's stop putting women in front as cases, deal with the problem.
I think Greg's story, if I'm, I think it was Greg.
Yeah, it was Greg Nixon.
Wrote a story last week where he did exactly that.
He
spoke about an incident when he was like 14 or 15 years old or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, with a bunch of boys sitting around drinking and, you know, talking in with male bravado and so on, with a situation where there was a young a girl with them as well, who also got a bit drunk and ended up behind the bushes with men lining up to go and get oral sex from her. And Greg says he didn't participate in himself because he was too shy. But the fact is, he never challenged it. He never said, no, but this is unacceptable. Why are we doing this? And I think that that's the kind of thing, because, you know, and we've all got those stories. I can tell you, all of us, as men, have got those stories. I would challenge any man to say that they don't have those stories. That something happened in their lives when they had a conversation with somebody, or they observed something happening, or they did something themselves, and they didn't question what they were doing. They didn't question the ethics, the values that were contained in the thing that they did. And I think Nhlanhla's right. We need to face up to those things and acknowledge them, because that's the step towards changing things. We can't point fingers and say, and as Nhlanhla was saying, is a lot of, you know, what is the phrase they've been using? Men are
trash.
Men are trash. Yes. And then people are saying, no, but not all men. You know, the fact is that at the end of the day, unless we as men actively on a day-to-day basis take part in stopping these kinds of things happening and changing society, we're part of the problem.
I'm glad that that's come up. I think that's important. We can't get away from it. Maurice Smithers, Nhlanhla Skoskana, thank you so much for spending time with me and talking us through some of the really important work you're doing.
Thank you for having us.
Those tuning in, we're just going to go to a quick break and then we'll be right back after this. Good afternoon. You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. We're just going to the last portion of the show where we're discussing gender-based violence and trying to see where are the things in the system that fall apart. Where are the things that we need to do better? We spoke a bit about issues of a national strategic plan and a lack of coordination nationally, a lack of a budget, a lack of tangible outcomes that we can hold people accountable to using. Talk a bit about criminal justice, where the bail system falls apart, where issues of competent judges, instances of lawyers and lawyer fees that people can afford. Last, we're going to speak a bit about prevention. What are some of the things that we can do beforehand that make people less likely to commit these kinds of crimes? On the line, we have Nwabisa Shai, who's at the Gender and Health Division at the South African Medical Research Council. Nwabisa, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Nwabisa. So, Nwabisa, your sort of area expertise is really talking a bit about prevention and what's the stuff we're doing now that's working and that we can just need to put more attention to and try and scale up. First, I'd love if you could just talk a bit about the idea of group-based interventions. What is that and what are some of the results we're seeing out of those kinds of things?
Okay. So group-based interventions are participatory interventions that are standardized. And they are meant to get a group of people with similar characteristics. So, for example, young men of a particular age or young women of a particular age. And they come together to discuss issues of common interest amongst themselves. But the aspect of the kinds of interventions that we have been using for HIV prevention or gender-based violence prevention, the idea is that we use a number of participatory methods like role plays, drama, group discussions, critical reflection, but doing that as a group and getting everybody sharing together, whether it is similarities or differences in opinion or experiences. And that gets a conversation going and helps people to reflect and even beyond the particular setting of the actual workshop.
Okay, wonderful. One particular one that's come up is one called Stepping Stones, which has shown to be able to reduce men's sort of likelihood to perpetrate intimate partner violence. Could you talk a bit about this Stepping Stones program, how it works, and what are the results we're seeing from it?
Okay, so Stepping Stones is one of those group-based interventions. It was initially used as an HIV prevention intervention, but for South Africa, we had adapted it in order to include gender-based violence prevention. So there's a very strong element that's focusing at building a gender equitable relationship where there's harmony and a good assertive communication amongst people who are in a particular relationship. And it was looking at sexual relationships, hence the focus on gender-based violence within relationships, as well as looking at some of the different forms of gender-based violence that also include non-partner rape. And so what Stepping Stones has been able to do is that we worked with young people in South Africa where we grouped them according to men and women. And the program itself allows participants to work separately according to their gender group. But then they come together to have a peer session where men and women will share their ideas about particular experiences. So, for example, looking at expectations on what it means to be a woman or what it means to be a man, then you get people in a peer group setting sharing these ideas and talking about what is fair about these social expectations, what is not fair about them, what is achievable and what is not achievable, and being able to exchange ideas about what is fair on women or not fair on women, what is fair on men and not fair on men. And that is part of the component that's helping to build gender equitable ideas. And we do the same thing with sessions that also focus on gender, understanding different forms of gender-based violence, understanding how the law works and what kinds of responses we have, for example, at the state level, through the ability to report that is covered under the Domestic Violence Act, and also what kinds of expectations we should have when we are using that, and how the community themselves can support each other when a situation that involves, for example, domestic violence occurs.
I mean, these are, you know, clearly really very comprehensive programs, and your studies and sort of monitoring and evaluation processes are saying these things work. So I suppose the big question is, how do we get more of these? How do we get these into more communities, into more homes, into more schools? I'd love if you could talk us through sort of the processes that have gone forth, or not the processes, but the track record of trying to scale projects like these. You mentioned another program called Sinovuyo that is sort of in the process of scaling and trying to get bigger. Could you talk us through sort of the process of doing that and some of the challenges that come up when trying to get these to impact more people?
Well, scaling up is really a challenge because these interventions themselves, they involve quite a lot of input in terms of financial as well as human resources. But this can also be done at a large scale, but at the same time, it just requires a proper alignment and integration with the current policies that are being implemented, for example, by departments like social development. With the example of Sinovuyo, where what we have is that we have a program that is looking at a model that is covering issues around addressing issues of the child and the parent child relationship. And that program has been integrated with the work that is being supported and delivered through an agency that is supported by the Department of Social Development called Isilindi. And so what we have there, we have a community and youth care workers that are working together in order to address issues, for example, of assisting people within their homes, to ensure well-being, where they also provide practical assistance on how to help with homework and how to help with health issues. Also, psychosocial issues are also addressed. And that program is nicely integrated with the with an existing agency that is already implementing this kind of work. Mm. But the challenge with that is that we find that our existing organizations follow certain programs already, and being able to integrate with another new program that is standardized, possibly in a different way to what is already existing, requires skills and requires a lot of support. And I suppose also it requires a lot more human resources.
Yeah.
And that becomes a challenge. And with lack of funding, when it comes to scale up, we find that it's actually difficult to take these very good programs into scale. And another challenge that we have with scale up is that we don't have lots of studies on these interventions that are talking to how they can be costed. And so we don't know how much they're going to cost. But currently we have two studies. One is Stepping Stones with another program that is looking at livelihood strengthening, working with young people in formal settlements that is currently being run. We're having a randomized control trial taking place. And part of that is doing a big costing component that is going to help us to be able to say how much is it going to cost any agency that takes up this intervention. And another challenge also is that we need to be able to map the policies we have, the current actions that are being taken by different parties across across government that are looking at violence prevention. So we have primary prevention that we need to focus on. And so we need to be able to group those policies that talk to that aspect, as well as the one that talks to the aspect of secondary prevention that's looking at, for example, the criminal justice system and how it responds well to cases that come to the state. And so we need to have this proper alignment in making sure that we have an oversight body that is looking at making sure that for the different types of levels of intervention, we are able to address violence against children, violence against women, and also even perhaps other violence prevention programs that we have across the state. And you will find that these policies are existing, but they are often talking to each other, but in a disjointed way. So through a dialogue forum that I'm currently working with a group of other government departments like social development, the performance and evaluation department, with other academia and civil society, we're trying to work at creating this map that's going to help us to integrate violence prevention practice and policy and come up with concise ways so that you can follow a certain roadmap of what do you do if you need a particular type of program. For example, if you want Stepping Stones, who is it designed for? Who will it benefit? And who do you need? And what do you need in order to be able to implement it at a community level and at a wide scale?
Mabisa, thank you so much. I mean, I don't think I could possibly hope to sort of sum up some of the challenges as well as you have. It sounds like the issue of sort of coordination and oversight and tangible outcomes, it seems like it's something we just can't escape.
Lots of funding.
Thank you for squeezing that in there. And of course, the element that it sounds like we can't over rely on criminal justice. It sounds like it's, Like it's limited. It's important and necessary, of course, but it sounds like we can't get away from the fact that these are socio-cultural issues, and prevention needs to be rooted in conversations, in community-based interventions, and perhaps we need to shift the conversation into that direction.
And financial prevention is actually key, because it is the foundation of our thinking. Yeah. So if you want to prevent violence before it happens, we need to do that at a foundation level. Mm. So for example, if we want to prevent violence against children, it means the parents need to adopt a certain way, for example, a different way to solve conflict, say amongst, say, the parents themselves, or within, amongst the adults within the family. And also, if we're thinking about ways at a community level, the conversations themselves need to be more gender equitable. Our attitude towards women and girls needs to be more gender equitable. And how we bring up boys also needs to be looked at. And it means that our entire conversation as South Africans needs to change. And the most important people here are children, because they are the ones who learn these behaviors from adults. They are the ones who are easy to influence, because if you're thinking about socialization at the family level, the parents are responsible for what the children know. The community at large is responsible for what the community knows. The teachers at schools are the ones that are informing the minds of these children. And so if we talk about violence, or we talk about risk factors for violence in a way that doesn't inculcate an understanding that violence is something that should not be taking place within our families, within our schools, within our community, then the children are not going to learn that. And so that is where we need to focus on.
I couldn't put it better myself. Mabisa Shai from South African Medical Research Council, thank you so much for chatting to us.
Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. For those tuning in, thank you for listening to this episode of the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. I think it's clear there's a lot of work to do, but that should not paralyze us. Rather, that should, you know, spur us into action and say, what can we do? Whether it starts from attending this march that's coming up this 26th in Soweto, whether it starts from contributing and funding organizations like Sonke, like the South African Medical Research Council, whether it's having conversations as men, especially in our groups, in our families, in our churches, in our sports teams, of saying, what are we doing? But I think the message is clear that something has to change. I mean, South Africa's rate of the killing of women, femicide, is 5 times higher than the global average. 5 times. Something fundamentally has to change, and we all have to be a part of making that happen. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Same time, same place.
Cliffcentral.com.